Welcome to the Church and Family Life podcast. Fasten your seatbelt. You're going to hear a great story from Michael Foster. He's going to be preaching at our conference, Manhood and Womanhood, The Glory of God and the Creation Order. I hope you enjoy the story. So Jason, it's life story time. These are always a real joy. We do this so that people who hear the preaching at our conferences can know a little bit more about the guy so they can understand where he's coming from.
These are my favorites.
Yeah, they really are. And we got Michael Foster on, pastor of East River Church, author, a fun-to-read author, actually. I really appreciate the stuff you're writing these days. So, Michael, welcome. Hey, tell us the story of your life. You know, start at the beginning.
Well, thanks for having me. Yeah, I haven't done this for a bit. So I'm the oldest of three brothers. There's 2 years between each of us. And my mom met my dad while he was out on probation, as I recall, for Grand Theft Auto. And they met at a disco in Kansas City. My dad is from Independence, Missouri, across the river. My mom is from Chicago. My maternal grandfather, he died when she was 11. And my grandmother kind of freaked out and moved to Kansas to do this radical reboot where she started a home for a foster home that had like 14 kids in it with my mom and her brother, my uncle. And so my mom was kind of like thrusted into being a little mom to all these kids that my grandmother was looking over, and had a slightly rebellious stage and met my dad at a disco and they got really involved, and I was conceived, and then they got married. And so I grew up in sort of KCMO part of the country for the first 6 years of my life. And not really a Christian family at all. I think there was a sort of Christianity was in the water around them. My grandfather, my mom's dad, was a Presbyterian, but I never knew him. And my dad's dad was really New Age. He wrote a couple books on what demons had told him. He didn't call them demons. He called them the guardians. And so he was really into all that stuff. And my dad grew up doing lots of drugs and getting in lots of trouble. And so that's the home I was kind of born into.
Was he around? Was he around much when you were growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My parents stayed married until they were married for 29 years and they divorced. So I grew up in a home with them the majority of my life. It was not a happy marriage. I think they loved each other, but it was just dysfunctional. They fought a lot. I cannot remember many nights where they didn't fight growing up.
Boy.
So I definitely grew up in a very rough household.
What were your thoughts about the drug use and stuff like that? Did that hit you?
So my dad overcame drugs before I came to age where I could remember. He, however, did have a major problem with gambling and with alcohol. And so he was an alcoholic and certainly gambled away our rent money several times, which I think he would admit to now. And I can remember coming, as I got older, we lived above a bar in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, right across from Seagram's whiskey plant. And I have to go out there. He'd be so drunk. I'd have to go out there with a blanket and cover him up and just leave him on the sidewalk. And he wasn't like that at all times. There was sober years. And I remember I went to go see him when I was six. He was staying at some sort of like AA like camp where they sober up and all this stuff. And back then, Thundercats was a really popular 80s cartoon. And the main character's name was Lion-O. He's like this, the leader. But I said it Wino, that I was looking for a Wino. And everyone at this sort of Alcohol Anonymous group really got a kick out of that. But I was pretty disturbed little kid, like very angry, would have crazy outbursts. And I was going to Shawnee Mission Elementary School. And I once like army crawled underneath my teacher's desk and bit her. So, I don't really know why I was doing that stuff. I don't really know where all that anger came from. I think children are very sensitive to their environment, and they, I didn't know this for many, many years, but basically the guidance counselor said, you got to get your son out of this school. They're going to put him in a special ed class. He'll be labeled that the rest of his life. And, I didn't know that, but my mom sent me to live with my grandmother, had since remarried and relocated to Southern Indiana. She married an old farmer who had also been a correctional officer and had retired, Paul Peets, who was my functional grandfather, even though he's my step-grandfather. So I went out to Osgood, Indiana, a town of 1,100 people, and moved in with my grandmother. And she still had one of the people that she had adopted, my Uncle Roberto, who is half Black, half Lakota Indian, and had all sorts of health problems. But he functionally was like my older brother. He was only 6 years older than me. He was really into Dungeons and Dragons, which doesn't necessarily have to be like this deep evil, but he kind of took it to the dark places, watched a lot of horror movies, was into all that sort of stuff. Some of it was innocent, like sci-fi, but a lot of the stuff he was into was kind of dark. My grandmother, however, was survived the bombing of Dresden. She's from Königsberg, and she came to the States after World War II. And old, tough woman, German woman. And my grandfather, like I said, was a farmer and a retired correctional officer. So my life went through a radical change when I went to live with my grandparents. So even though I'm Gen X, I really was raised by a much older generation, and they had a lot of impact in my life. When I came out there, I wouldn't eat anything, but chicken nuggets and hamburgers and hot dogs. And Germans eat disgusting things. They eat brown Schwager. They eat blood sausage, brain cheese. They just eat like all the worst things in the world. And this stuff would get served to me. And I remember I'd have to eat cow's tongue, and we'd always say it's the food that takes you back. Right. So then, with my grandmother, if you don't eat, so I would sit down at the dinner table and I would get in trouble if I wouldn't eat. And what I would do is I would sometimes eat it and swallow it with water. So she wouldn't let me have water to the very end of the meal. And if I didn't eat it for dinner, it got served to me for breakfast. And then it was served to me again for dinner. If I didn't eat it then, I got spanked and sent to bed. And they really broke me down. But one story I tell to people, I've told to my children anyhow, is that I can remember in the middle of the night getting up and going into the kitchen and eating a piece of cheesecake that was in the fridge, and waking up the next morning and being confronted by my grandmother whether or not I had ate that cheesecake. And I denied it, right? Like, that would have been a capital offense in my parents' household. We were so poor. We didn't have anything. That would have been something very special you'd rarely have. And my grandma, Michael, you know you did it. And I still wouldn't admit it. And then that night, she gave me like this huge piece of peach cobbler and said, this is your home. You're allowed to eat this stuff. Right. So it was a grace that I wasn't really used to. I don't think she was a Christian at the time, although we did occasionally go to a Lutheran church in Napoleon, Indiana. But it had structure and had all those old values. And that really ended up setting me aside from my brothers, who grew up mostly underneath my parents. So I lived with my grandmother a couple of years and then spent almost every summer there and many weekends there. So I kind of grew up in two homes. I grew up with my grandparents and my adopted uncle, and I grew up with my parents. And they were very different worlds. One was a country house with structure and discipline. And with my parents, we bounced all around. They eventually moved to Indiana, took me back. Then we went to Bloomington, Indiana, lived on university campus. I went to University Elementary, very liberal, right? That's where the sexual revolution started with Kinsey and all that. So it's this little toxic cesspool of liberalism amongst corn and quarries. I was taught about all sorts of sexual perversity in fifth grade while there. It was just very where we are now. Like, Bloomington's been there for a long time.
Wow.
So then we ended up kind of bouncing around a lot, where we went to Goodland, Kansas for a little bit. Then we went to Greensburg, Indiana, and then from Greensburg out to Roanoke, Virginia, and Roanoke, Virginia, back to Indiana, and then eventually landed in Lawrenceburg, Indiana. And very unstable environment. When you're a kid in environments like that, you're always trying to recreate yourself at each school. And since you don't have a history, you can kind of do that, right? And I can remember being at my senior graduation, and we had, you know, a couple of days before the graduation, we all met in the cafeteria and they played this video. And so many of my peers had gone to elementary school together and had all these shared experiences and all these connections. I had none of that, right? And so I didn't have a deep connection to place outside of my grandmother's farm. So I think I idealized Osgood, Indiana, and living on a farm and having goats and cows and chickens. And I was a little boy, would terrorize all the cows until they once I tried to catch a calf, and the mother cow did not take too kindly to that and tossed me into a barbed wire fence. So then I came out and shot the cow with my BB gun the next day. When I was with my parents, it was a lot of instability. They were not Christians. They would never be against Christianity, right? They'd be for America and anything that's good. They were very conservative, at least in their professed values, but wouldn't really go to church or anything like that, and had a tendency to expose us to a lot of occult stuff, cult books, cult movies. I think we grew up kind of a fearful group of little boys, and I was a big reader. I started reading novels like third and fourth grade. And the first novel I ever read from start to finish was the book It by Stephen King in fourth grade. It was a very bad book for a kid to read. But yeah, I was a very bookish nerd, really all into middle school. And I've been reading a book a week since I've been a little boy. And I got that from my mom. My mom is a huge reader. So I'm always in the middle of a couple books. And right now I'm working through a lot of Midwestern fiction. So so I wasn't inclined towards sports or anything like that. But when I hit middle school, I realized I had to kind of change, and that being a smart kid wasn't paying off at all. It wasn't socially paying off. And I became friends with a couple guys that were into boxing. So I got into boxing. I got into mixed martial arts, and I love football. I wrestled all throughout high school. My kids wrestle. I was a wrestling coach at one point. And so I kind of really started to change between eighth and ninth grade into a different guy. Hit the weights, you know, put on muscle mass, went from not being able to lift 100 pounds to repping, you know, 245 with ease, and really got into that sort of stuff. And then started hanging with a cool crew, you know, being one of the cool kids. I was team captain on my wrestling team and team captain on cross country. I wasn't good at cross country. I just did it to keep my weight down, you know. So cross country was frustrating. In wrestling, I could take my frustrations out on the person I'm wrestling against. In cross country, they're just too quick for me to catch up to. So I got cool. I got a girlfriend. I got all the things that probably a middle schooler thought would make you happy. And I wasn't really happy. And at the time, my youngest brother, Wayne, started going to this Pentecostal church where they were teaching him about Jesus. And I had been pretty much agnostic my entire life and never really thought about God almost at all. There's certainly a presence, like a feeling of judgment that all people have, right? Everyone knows they're under judgment. They feel it. When you watch horror movies, the judgment you feel is the monster, right? And God is a monster to those who are rebels. I think that's the underlying psychology to a lot of those horror movies, you know? But I never really thought about Christianity at all until high school, where all these Christians started carrying their Bibles around to class. It was annoying to me. Like, it was annoying because I didn't see them reading them. It was annoying when I confronted them to ask them why they believed what they believed. And that they couldn't give me a real good answer. I'd gotten really into Arthur C. Clarke and Carl Sagan and a lot of the kind of predecessors to what would eventually become New Atheism, which is already dead now, right? So the waves of history just keep on smashing against the shore. And so I became a pretty aggressive atheist in high school. And I also, a lot of the girls I knew who were professing Christ were sleeping with my friends or being sexually active with my friends. So I remember telling this one girl, Amanda, she said, "Why aren't you a Christian, Michael?" And I said, "Look, Amanda, don't waste your time here, okay? Even if Jesus is real, I can pretty much guarantee that he doesn't want you to be his PR, okay? I know what you did this past weekend." So I was surrounded by a lot of that sort of hypocrisy. Mm-hmm. And I used to watch the TBN for fun because I thought it was hilarious. I used to prank Benny Hinn all the time. I used to prank him and say, you know, "What if I give you $10,000, you know, or what if you give me $10,000? Won't you get $100,000 back?" Or I used to call them and confess to fake sins. Like, "I'm calling because I need to know, is it gluttony if I'm just eating vegetables? I eat so much vegetables, I get sick." We just like mess with these people all the time.
And too much time on your hands.
Man, it was the 90s. We didn't have the internet quite yet. And we just back then, there was no Star 69. You could prank someone and they didn't know who you were. You know, those days are gone. But but we would mock Christianity quite a bit. And so Wayne starts going to this Pentecostal thing, and my mom gets convicted by it and starts going to a different church with a guy she met at work. And then all my brothers go. I was probably 15 or 16 at the time. I refused to go. And then my dad, who had been struggling with alcoholism, drunk in biblical terms, he goes and he stops drinking. And I won't lie, that did capture my – that was like quite a change. Mm-hmm. You know? And but still, I was really annoyed because – It just seemed very social to me. And so at the time, you know, I got all these people talking to me about Christianity all the time. And I had this girl I was dating that I thought I was going to marry and all this stuff. And I remember she once told me, don't you go be like one of those Christians. And honestly, that made me upset. I'm like, look, I'm going to do what's true. Like, don't tell me I can't be a Christian. Like, I don't think she understood that I was trying to the pursuit of truth, right? But I can remember people saying, "Why do you reject Christianity?" And I'd say, "Well, I believe in selfism, that you should make yourself the best person." So I was just like a lost, unregenerate, mm-hmm. self-centered, narcissistic, better than everybody pagan. Right. That's like, you know, what I was. And so then I got into some fights. I got expelled from school. I got in a lot of trouble, and it had me kind of questioning, you know, what mattered. And so I went to church on Easter. My mom begged me to. I went there for her. And then I would go to the youth group every once in a while. And they were like really fascinated that I would show up. And I remember this one guy, he would always whisper cuss words in my ear during worship songs, and because he thought it was cool. And I was like, it's not cool. You know, and I cussed all the time, right? Like all the time. But I was like, man, all these people trying to be something they're not. It was annoying to me. But I had this biology teacher, Coach Bow, who is a man of science. He was a reserve football coach. His two sons were two of the best athletes in Indiana state history. He was everything I thought a man should be, right? Manly, smart, well-educated, respected, helps people. And I had him in a class where he wouldn't teach on evolution, and it was so frustrating to me. And then he told me he didn't believe in evolution, which I didn't know such people existed. I was like, what do you mean you don't believe in evolution? Yeah. And so then he explains it all to me. And I had this girl, Margaret Smith. Poor Margaret was like, had to deal with me harassing her for being a Christian. But she was just godly. She didn't have good answers, but I couldn't deny there was a quality of her life. Couldn't deny that there was a quality to her life that I hadn't seen elsewhere. And So I did what every guy does when he meets a woman he's fascinated by and can't explain. I tried to get her to go on a date, and that didn't work out. But I remember at the end of that sophomore year, she said, "What are you going to do this summer?" And I said, "I think I'm going to try to get closer to God." She said, "Really?" I was like, I don't know. I just want to see if there is a God. And if there is, I think, you know, I should probably have some sort of relationship or knowledge. And so I go to this basketball tournament with the guy that liked to cuss in my ears. And it turned out it was not a basketball tournament. It turned out it was like, it was a 2-on-2, but they also had this guy come out, preach the gospel. And he preaches the gospel. And they have an altar call, you know, it's in Southern Indiana. And I walk up and pray with them. And God just, I just got saved. But the Holy Spirit, it wasn't evidence. It wasn't this or that crisis. It was scales removed from my eyes. I once was lost, now was found. I saw and believed.
So how old are you? You're now at late high school, right?
17.
Yeah.
And then all these guys surround me and lay hands on me, and they start going, cha-da-da-da-ga-ga-ba-ba-ba.
Oh, no.
So, like, I'm not, like, I wasn't much of a feeler at the time. And so anyway, I kind of, like, sneak out of the crowd almost. I, like, almost, like, they didn't even know I was gone. And I went outside, and I told God, I said, "All right, I was wrong. I was wrong. You're real." And I was like, "But this is too much. Like, please be patient with me." And then immediately started attending church. I would confront people at school. I'd go from table to table during lunch and witness to people. I was a pretty big, intimidating guy at this point, and would just not hold back. Started going to Bible studies. One night after my non-Christian friends had ditched me, I ran to these skateboarders at a local drugstore where they were skating, and they invited me to go to Bible studies with me. And I'm still close friends with one of them. I talk to every week, and he's here in town many years later. And we did, so I just got pulled into these Bible studies and ended up at a Calvary Chapel, which I always tell people is a great starter church because they actually love the Bible, you know. And, they accidentally made me reformed by turning me on to Martin Lloyd-Jones and to a book by John MacArthur on that he edited. He had a great chapter on expository preaching throughout the centuries. And I went and bought all these commentaries from those people. Immediately started reading. The first book I ever read after I converted was Augustine's Confessions in the Cross and the Switchblade, because that's what was in our high school library.
Yeah.
And so I've always kind of had an eclectic mix of influences. And then when I went to college, I became pretty much obsessed with the church fathers. So I have a son named Athanasius, a son named Cademan, a son named Cyprian. I had a daughter who passed away named Nicaea. I really loved that stuff and slowly became reformed. And I never thought I'd be a pastor in a million years. I wasn't a people person back then, but God really changed me and met my wife at a Bible study. Knew she was the one. We dated for 4 years, which is way too long, all throughout high school, and got married. God's blessed us with 9 children and 8 with us, 1 ahead of us. And we actually celebrated 22 years of marriage last Saturday. Yeah. And it's a good life, man. It's good to know Jesus. I'm glad to be saved. I'm glad to be among his people with my name in his book. And yeah, that's kind of, there's so much more to everyone's story, but that's my story in 25 minutes.
Oh, my. Okay, so how did you become a pastor? What's the story on that?
So it's kind of funny, actually. One of the skateboarders I met at that drugstore, he disappeared because he met a girl, and they wanted to hang out. So he asked if I could fill in for him 1 week at the 2 Bible studies he taught. And he just never came back. So, like, I became the guy. And and at that time, I hadn't even read the entire Bible. And so I would go read, I don't know how many times I've read through Matthew Henry's commentaries, but I bought Matthew Henry's commentary from Barnes & Noble and would just read through it and make notes and then go teach these Bible studies. These Bible studies grew from like 10 to 12 people at one point to like 105 people. And we had to like pray there wouldn't rain. We'd meet outside like these little teen Bible studies. And then I became the head of a skateboard ministry that we would set up all these skateboard ramps, and hundreds of kids would come and skate, and we'd set them all down and preach the gospel. News would come out there all the time. And so me and a couple of friends ran that ministry for about 3 years.
Wow.
Traveling all over America.
That's neat.
And it's cool to see the old newspaper articles. And so all we ever knew was teaching Bible studies and street preaching. And Calvary Chapel has a really heavy emphasis on church planting. And I fell in love with that and slowly realized I was called to the ministry. I fought it because I never idealized the ministry. I knew it was going to be costly. And I knew that it would mean a lot of people not liking you, hating you for stupid reasons. And slowly but surely, I really just resigned myself to that calling. So I've been an assistant associate pastor, and I've planted two churches. And I love being a shepherd. I love the people. I think I always hear people say ministry is great except for the people. The people are the ministry, right? I get the tongue in cheek, but you got to protect your heart, right? The glory is being there from birth to death, marriage, high points, low points, and seeing folks become people you never imagined in a million years mm-hmm. they would become because God's grace is so powerful.
Hmm. Theological heroes over the years. They change, right? They move.
They don't move too much for me. Calvin is my go-to. I love John Calvin. If you talk about John Calvin like he's a dead intellectual, I know you haven't read him. Calvin is – I love his pastoral heart. Good book is Calvin's Company of Pastors. It's a fantastic book on that. I actually read his consistory notes. I got a copy of that. It cost a lot. Martin Lloyd-Jones is like a lot of people. He's been a big influence. I love J.C. Ryle, Thomas Watson. I love those Puritan guys that were punchy but accessible, mm-hmm. right?
Super practical, yeah.
Yeah, I can't stand John Owen. I can't stand him. Mm-hmm. I know people love him. I just hate his writings. And I would recommend The Doctrine of Repentance over John Owen almost any day because I just think The Doctrine of Repentance by Watson is such a better, more mm-hmm. accessible way to mortify sin than Owen stuff. And I know people get upset by that, but I just want people to read a book and actually apply it. And I'm like, oh, good, you read Owen, you know? And I think, look, he's a gifted man, but I love those guys that are easy to grab a hold of. So a lot of those punchy Puritans. I love Thomas Manton. He's great. I'm deeply influenced by all the writings on the Westminster Standards. I love reading that stuff just for fun. So that'd be some of them. I don't have very many. I love Chuck Smith. Chuck Smith was an imperfect man, had all sorts of problems.
Yeah.
Had a couple occasions to meet him. I just love his love for the Bible and his risk-taking nature, which didn't always pay off.
Yeah, he did. He took a lot of risk on a lot of young guys. And some of them worked out really good, right?
Yep, they did. And I think that's something I'd love to see more in pastors again. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, that's really great. Okay, so you've been writing books. You wrote a book. We're going to talk about that mm-hmm. in another podcast.
Yep.
What do the next 5 years look like for you?
Well, I really love where I'm at. I love Claremont County. I love Batavia. I'm a localist. I really think you should spend about 80% of your effort on the time and place God's put you. And God's put me in Claremont County right now. And so these are the people I want to give attention to. So I'm writing a whole lot. I wake up every morning and I write 1,000 to 2,000 words every morning just out of mm-hmm. practice, you know. And I'm working on a couple books right now. I've got a book over at Founders. It's a devotionary, is what we're calling it. A little more than a devotional, a little less than a commentary. it's on the Sermon on the Mount. It's about 1,200 words each entry is. So you could use mm-hmm. it as a family devotional. I've got that book over there. I've got Blue Collar Confessionalism, which is kind of my reflection on the search for a people, place, and a past that I think is a big part of the Americans are confused and they're trying to find a place they belong. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like writing on recapturing American Christianity. So doing that. And then me and Emily are trying to finish a book that's on marriage and children. It may be called It's Good to Be Married. Certainly would sell better if I did that. I just don't like doing that stuff. I like having a different name and I don't like running brands into the ground. I hate when it was like Wild at Heart for 12-year-old Mexicans. You know, like I know it's you can sell it, but that's maybe I'm a little bit of a hipster in that way that I want to do it different every time.
But you're not going to have chicken soup for everything.
No,
in the world.
No, I hate that stuff. But yeah, I think those are the things I'm trying to get done. Those are pretty far along projects. And I've written a book called Troublemakers, which is a book for a 10 to 12 year old boy would love it. And it's just all the stuff me and my brothers got into, which is like something like you'd read. It's like an 80s movie like Sandlot. Like that was our childhood. We grew up in a time where we would disappear for 12 hours a day and no one knew where we were. And little did they know we were riding the back of trains and jumping off train bridges and building boats and going down a river and stealing entire dumpster full of Frito-Lay chips that were past their Best Buy date. I mean, these are the things that I my kids love when I tell these stories. So I thought it'd be kind of fun to tell that story. So I'm really very much just writing. I don't do conferences very much anymore. But you know, I like what you guys are doing at yours. You know, I really do care about the family and church. That's more of my domain than being a cultural commentator. I want to be connected to what's going on in the culture. I care about it. Mm-hmm. But want it to be very applicable, to the people that are in front of me. That's what really burdens me at this time in my life.
Yeah. Wow, Michael, thank you so much. What a great story. Thanks. Hey, can't wait to have you at our conference. And until we meet again. Thanks so much.
God bless.
And thank you for joining us on the Church and Family Life podcast. Hope you can be with us next time.
Church and Family Life is proclaiming the sufficiency of Scripture by helping build strong families and strong churches. If you found this resource helpful, we encourage you to check out churchandfamilylife.com.